Sehr gut. So, welcome everybody to our first Datengarten at the Seabase. Today we made the move not too far, but yeah, quite a bit in Berlin, from the CCCB to Seabase, since we have a great talk and CCCB is not as spacey as here, so we have more spacey decorations, but also a lot, especially more space. So all of you have a nice seat. And if somebody's just looking into the stream, there's still some seats left, so if you still want to come over, please do so. Before we start, one short announcement. So normally it's okay to smoke in here, but during the talk, we kindly ask you to smoke outside so that we will still be able to see the beamer. So what we'll see today is Datengarten number 57. And the topic is from secret maneuvers to undercover research. And we have Evelyn Lubbers here, who will give a talk, who already wrote a book to the same topic and will tell us how all this started back with the UK scandal that, there were spies in the activist area and so on, but I don't want to tell too much. But since we did the Datengarten and why we announced it, so today we spotted something on the net, and I mean, in our opinion, it's mainly because we do the Datengarten, they thought it would fit perfectly. So there's an initiative from the PEN Collective. Perhaps you have seen it today somewhere? You have got it? It's about an program for intelligence officers to exit it, so like you have for Nazis and stuff, so we have now this. And they made a nice video, which we want to show you as a short introduction into the topic, and afterwards Evelyn give her talk. So please play the video.
Zehn Jahre gebraucht, um zu erkennen, wofür ich bei der Staatssicherheit verantwortlich gewesen bin.
I was radioactive because I'm questioning, what are we doing? Where do you then go? Where does your life then, where do you recreate your life?
What Intellexa does is help individuals transition from the world on the inside to the world on the outside.
Wissen Sie, dieser Intel-Excel-Verein ist wirklich eine gute Sache.
the more you can move from the inside to the outside, the better you'll integrate into the real world.
What is really great about IntellExit is that it helps people to confront their fears.
So take it from me, if you're looking to get out, try IntellExit.
Be smart. Exit intelligence now.
So if you know somebody, you can send them to this website. So if you think somebody might be intelligent or somewhere. So now you're prepared and you got an idea how to get out. But first we want to know, how did these people get in and what do they do? So now we have our talk from Evelyn Lober. So a big hand of applause, please. And if you have questions later on, please do. We will have them at the end of the talk. Then raise your hand and you will get a microphone. So is it also the people on the stream and in front of the SPCs can see and hear what you're asking. So a big hand of applause. Thank you very much.
I can't really see you. It's very much like being on a real stage. I am Dutch. I do understand German and I do speak it, but I'd rather do this talk in English. I will try to speak not too fast so everybody can understand me. Are there any people who really don't speak any English and they can maybe sit next to someone who can translate for them? No? Okay. What I will talk about tonight, I will first introduce myself a little bit, tell you something about my background. I will tell you about the undercover policing scandal as it broke out in the United Kingdom and how I am involved in it, and I will talk a bit about what happens in Germany. Then I will introduce to you the Undercover Research Group, something I have set up with several other people. And maybe at the end we can talk about how you as a hacker community can help. Of course, this is a very different way of spying we're talking about here than the big data stuff that you are usually dealing with. This is about personal infiltrating of police spies into movements, into activist groups. About myself a little bit, my background is in the activist movement in Amsterdam in the early 80s. We had a big Hausbesetzerbewegung, squatters movement, which sort of was mingled with other activist groups, with anti-militarism, with peace groups. And of course, we had confrontations with the police. There were riots in the streets. Also, people were approached by the police to give information. And because it had been quite a while since the Netherlands had riots, the police was sort of surprised by it and was trying to make new strategies how to deal with all this protest. And we thought maybe if they are making all these plans, it might be good to monitor them a bit closer so we know what is going to happen. With a few other activists, we started Bureau Janssen and Janssen, which is in German Schulze und Schulze. It's named after the two detectives in the Tintin comic, because we knew that we were gonna deal with heavy stuff and with paranoia and with all kind of sort of not so nice stuff. But we tried to keep sort of a light tone as well, because as you all know, dealing and monitoring police and intelligence can sort of draw you into into paranoid moods, and that's not what we want. We want to understand what's happening and see what we can do about it. So even early in the 80s, we already started to do research, and we exposed some spies, or we helped. We also helped. We did effect stuff that was discussed here. People who were asked to be an informer for the police, who came to us and said, what can we do? How can we deal with this? How can we get out? The police, if they ask people to become an informer, they are very specific in who they pick. They pick the people that they can sort of manage, or they're people with either money problems or psychological problems, or people who are not that strong in their life. So my experience really started there. In that line of work, we were also asked at a certain point to help a few groups who had suspicions about someone who is working for them. And in the end, we found out that he wasn't a spy for the police, but he was a spy for a private intelligence company. It's a really funny story. It's an interesting story in the sense that people had funny feelings about this guy, but he worked in different groups. For instance, the Clean Clothes Campaign, or a peace group, or a more radical group. And this was the early days of computers and of automatization. And he would have come with a software program, and he would offer to take the Rolodex home, the card system, and put all the addresses and all the contacts into the computer. And he also had what we thought was a strange interest, but for all kind of groups, he would collect the waste paper. So the bins that would be next to the copy machine and the fax machine that was used back in the days. Once every week, he would come with a van and a driver, because he said he didn't drive himself, and he would collect all the waste paper from all these groups. So only when people started to share their suspicions about this man, because nobody knew where he was coming from, he didn't have a direct phone number, just a phone number with a friend, and it changed all the time. Only when people started to share their suspicions about this guy, it turned out that he, as his motivation, his background story, he said that his family had once been involved in a big fight with a large corporation, and that he couldn't talk about that too much because that the family had settled that problem with the corporation, but that was sort of the core of his motivation to now, for instance, work with the Clean Clothes Campaign against CNA. And he would tell them that company that his family had a fight with was CNA. When he worked with an anti-apartheid group, I think it was a church group involved in the anti-apartheid boycott, he said that company had been an oil company. So he shared, when people got together and shared their stories, they found out that his background story was slightly different all the time. So when we set up this group to investigate this, we decided there were enough funny things about this guy to really try and find out something more about him. So one of the things, when he would collect the waste paper, of course all groups have piles of brochures or booklets that haven't been sold. He was never interested in that. He was only interested in the bins, basically, from next to the copy machine. So we set up really a sort of counterintelligence operation. We followed him in his car when he collected the paper, and he didn't go to the school where he said he collected the wasted paper for, because that school would sell the paper and, you know, the money would be sent to some school in Africa or whatever. He drove directly to an address where we later found out that a private security company was based. And it turned out that this company, set up by an ex-police officer, sold information to the same companies those activist groups fought against. So where that information landed, of course, we couldn't, you know, we're not the police, we couldn't raid that company, because we were so interested, of course, to know what was in those files in that company. So we had to do more research, and it turned out that, for instance, the Clean Clothes Campaign, where this guy had worked, they started a campaign to stand at the door of TNA shops, and they would, you know, it was a very friendly campaign and very peaceful. They said they would hand out, they were handing out cards with questions about child labor of where the clothes were made, and clients of the shop were supposed to hand in those cards when they would buy something in the CNA. Now, CNA, as you may know, is a very closed family company who's always, you know, they don't even, until, I don't know, maybe now they have, but until recently they didn't even have shares out, so they don't have annual reports. And they're very much a company who says, well, we do what we want to do and no, it's nobody else's business. But in this case, within a few days after the start of this campaign, they had this really nice brochure, almost written in the language of the activist group, like, we're very much against child labor, and we only want to sell clean clothes. Like, this was sort of a reference to the campaign. So in hindsight, we now think that because this guy knew that the campaign was coming, this allowed CNA to prepare their response to the campaign. So this is one of the reasons why large companies are interested in infiltrating movements as well. So I sort of, what I did next was write my first book. This is, I've brought my second book, the first, I don't have any copies of anymore, but that deals with how companies develop strategies to counter activist campaigns and how they need information for that. I then continued my work with sort of more in-depth research into how companies spy on activists and also cooperate with police in this case. I can tell some more about that later on. For this book, I worked in the UK a lot, and one of the cases I investigated was the infiltration by McDonald's agents by private hired by McDonald's, who infiltrated a very small group who was doing pickets. Who were doing pickets in front of McDonald's stores with a pamphlet that sort of summed up all everything that was wrong with McDonald's. McDonald's has a reputation of sending sort of threatening letters to everyone who criticizes them, and large companies like the BBC or Channel 4 or The Guardian, they don't want any fuss. They just decide to apologize for whatever they criticize McDonald's for. But this small group that was infiltrated, London Greenpeace, which has nothing to do with the larger Greenpeace, they existed earlier. They decided that once they got this threatening letter, that they would go to court, and you may know about it. This resulted in a court case, a libel case, that was the longest case in the UK in history, in which they had to defend their critics, they had to explain why the critique they had on McDonald's. But during that court case, they found out that their group had been spied upon. In fact, that their group had been infiltrated by so many activists that at many moments there would be as much activists as spies. Even McDonald's hired two different spy agencies, who didn't know about each other. So there would be spies from one company spying on the spies from the other company, and it's going to get worse, I'll tell you later. I researched this case, and it's related in a really weird way with the undercover scandal that we're going to talk about tonight, because it turned out later on that this small group was also infiltrated by the police at the same time. So there was such a small group, and they were, in fact, they were, before the spies came in, they they had been campaigning against McDonald's for years and years, and they were like, well, McDonald's, some other groups have to take over now. We want to do more, you know, we want to do a peace campaign or whatever. They wanted to do something else. And when the spies came in and all wanted to do McDonald's stuff, McDonald's sort of got higher on the agenda again. So they, and then they got this court notice. So that was very weird. So this is how I sort of moved my work from the Netherlands to UK. And 5 years ago, when my book was just out, Mark Kennedy was exposed. Mark Kennedy, I don't know how many people of you are familiar with this story at all, but I will explain a bit more. Mark Kennedy, it turned out, was infiltrated in environmental green groups for 7 years. And he lived the life of an activist, and he even had relationships with several women who really thought, you know, he was the love of their lives. Even after 7 years, when he was pulled out, he didn't know. Well, here's a case for this project that we just saw. He didn't know what to do with his life when he ended his work. He didn't want to work for the police anymore, and he tried to set up a company of his own to sell his information. And he came back. He came back to the same groups that he had infiltrated before, and that's also where it went wrong, because when he was infiltrating for the police, of course he had a false passport, false driving license, and he lived, he was called Mark Stone, everybody knew him as Mark Stone. But when he came back, he had to use his Mark Kennedy passport because the police had taken in all his false papers. And that's why, and that's how he got found out, because with one of his girlfriends, he went to Italy to an animal rights gathering. And on the way back, she was just rummaging on the dashboard, and she found this passport. And said, "Mark Kennedy, I thought you were Mark Stone." How? And he talked himself out of it, but that sort of ignited the first suspicion. And what the woman did, who found this out, she had a difficult. You know, she had a difficult time trying out what to think about this. But she then told only a few trusted people. And instead of, you know, starting rumors or starting a whispering starting all kind of rumors, this small group kept it very secret, but They investigated and tried to find out everything they could about Mark Kennedy. And when they sort of collected all the information they had, they confronted him and accused him of being a police officer. And he disappeared after that. And he confessed first that he was indeed, and he named some other names, and he then disappeared. So this group sort of, I think it was announced in the media that he was a spy, but they didn't go to the mainstream media. They just wanted to deal with the fact, think about it, that someone you've been working with for years, you've been doing radical action with, secret things, you've been arrested with him, and you find out that this guy was a spy. He was not the only one. After this came out, there were more people. It turned out that the story I was just telling you about London Greenpeace and McDonald's, one of the women in that group was Helen Steele, who was in the court case, the libel, McLibel court case. She had a boyfriend who had suddenly disappeared. She'd been with him for 2 years, and then he had a mental breakdown, and he disappeared out of her life. there were more women who had, through the years, had this experience. So in the end, I think within a year, six or seven of people were found out who to have been a spy. And one of the reasons why we were able to find this out was that one of the methods they had was using the identity of children who had died. So they used the birth certificate of a child that had died at a young age, and they used that like it's been done in The Day of the Jackal, one of those espionage thrillers. They took the birth certificate of one of these children and built the legend, their background story based on this child. And they would. What we found out that there was a sort of a pattern in all the stories of these undercover officers. They wouldn't have like. Nobody knew their family, or nobody ever saw anything. They would always have a story of a difficult childhood, why they wouldn't see their family anymore. There would always be reasons why you would never meet anybody of their former life. Mark Kennedy, for instance, I did a talk yesterday with Kate, who was one of his girlfriends. She asked him more about his background because she didn't really, they were newly in love and she didn't know anything about him. And then he shared a story. He said he had been involved with the mafia before and then he was in drugs trafficking and he was on the run, basically. And he sort of asked her to share that secret, to keep that secret, because he couldn't be exposed. That's what he said. That was his excuse to not tell more about his past. Of course, we later found out that he had been an undercover in drugs groups before he was an undercover in activist groups. So that's why he could talk about that so interestingly. So what we know now is that there used to be a unit called the Special Demonstration Squad. It was founded after the anti-Vietnam demonstrations back in 68 that ended in a riot, and the London mayor back at the authorities thought we never want this to happen again, so they sort of gave a lot of money to the police special branch, who set up a very secret unit who has been infiltrated in political groups ever since. So what we know now is that there were 7 to 10 secret agents in political groups all the time. So, and they would stay in the groups for like 4 or 5 years. It's police spies. I know you guys, when you deal with big data, you're dealing with intelligence services, the NSA usually. These are police spies. So there's a sort of, it's not MI5 or the Verfassungsschutz or the, it's a sort of the political police, basically. It's a very secret unit within special branch who sort of both deal with crime that is related with domestic extremism, but domestic extremism is not being described or defined anywhere. So that could be that such a unit could be involved with radical animal liberation groups, but once they stop doing their, you know, setting fire into an animal factory or whatever, they have nothing else to do anymore, so they just start spying on other much more friendly and environmental groups or other groups. So there's a kind of a mission creep. Some of the agents are also known to have suggested more radical actions than people in fact had planned to do. So they would act as an agent provocateur, or they would because they wanted their unit to exist and to remain in action, they maybe sometimes would make sure that there was a reason to suspect certain people, but they, you know, they initiated those actions. For instance, we know that at a certain point, three Debenhams stores, that's a store that sells fur. They were, there was a campaign against them. There was a small cell of three people who set fire to three different stores. Two people got caught, they were arrested, and they went to prison. And the third one was someone who is later exposed to be one of those infiltrators, Bob Lambert. So they, when the undercover police scandal broke, they are now starting a court case saying, there was an undercover policeman involved in our action, so he should have shared that information at the court case. So our court case has not been fair. It's a reason to get your sentence overturned. Of course, if you have been in jail, you still have been in jail, but you can get the court to decide about whether that was legal that happened. What I did at a certain point is, I have to put this another way. It's very important to know that this entire scandal and all the exposures of police officers, they came to light because of research by the activists themselves. It's not like that the police was suddenly very open and explained everything about it. On the contrary, there's a sort of several groups of activists who found out about this with the help of two journalists of The Guardian, and there have been, like, in the past four years, about a dozen internal police reviews into what went wrong. But of course they are more sort of a whitewash operation, and they're not very open. It's very important to remember that everything that came out is because of the research of these activists themselves. So what we did is we got together, I sort of pulled together the activists that were involved in this research and other people with a long-term experience from State Watch, from Corporate Watch, and we founded this group, the Undercover Research Group. And what we tried to do is we tried to go beyond the sensational story of undercover officers had sexual relationships with women. One fathered a child with one of the women. Of course, that's very important stories too. But like Kate said, explained in her talk yesterday, it took her a few years, but she now, you know, like, she now is able not to think about this as a relationship that hurt her very much, but it wasn't a relationship. She wasn't in a relationship with Mark Kennedy, because Mark Kennedy was just an instrument of the state, and he had contact with his handlers every day. So she had to deal with the feeling that, you know, whether she would have dinner or spend the night with her lover was in fact a decision of someone at the other end of Mark Kennedy's telephone, and maybe even higher up. So the state explicitly used these relationships with the women to get access to groups and to the movement, which means that, and not only for the women, but also for other people who had a long-term friendships and activist history with these people, they had to sort of, she was kind of warned that, of course you can think, okay, I have to have a political correct answer to this, and it's, but the emotional impact of what had happened to these women is incredible. There's now several groups. The most famous one is 8 different women who have been in relationships with spies like this, who have filed a court case against, not against the individual undercover agents, because like what I just explained, they don't think of the agents as the culprits, but it is against the Metropolitan Police, the London Police, who they hold responsible for what has happened. And Kate also explained that it's so weird being from an anarchist background and not believing in the state or in judges or in courts, that you now the only tools you have to fight against what has happened to you is court cases, questions in parliament. There's now even an independent public inquiry into everything that has gone wrong, which you don't want to believe in, but it's the only tool you have to get to know more. What we are doing with the Undercover Research Group is we try to profile the stories of these undercover officers, of the units they were in, because the Special Demonstration Squad stopped existing in 2006, and several other units have taken over with very long names, with very long acronyms that I'm not going to repeat here. We also look at those responsible, the supervisors, and how their careers have developed since they have done this undercover work. What we want to do is support other activists in their research by sharing all this knowledge, because if this happens to you, you really don't know where to start. And the way we do this research is there's no official material available, so we have to interview people who were involved, who worked with these spies. We look at the official reviews that I just talked about, investigating the police on what went wrong. Of course, there's not much in those reports, but it is useful to fine-comb them for little details. We have members in Parliament, even members in Parliament here in Germany, who have asked questions that gave us some information, because Mark Kennedy, for instance, came to Germany often. He was here at the G8 protest, the Heiligen Damm protest, and he was he had friends here, he had girlfriends here, and we know now by questions asked in Brussels as well that there exist groups at the European level who coordinate the operations of British undercover agents here, but also when the G8 was in Stirling in Scotland, we know that about 8 undercover police officers from Germany, German undercover police officers, came to the G8 in Scotland. So, as one of my questions here is, if there was such a unit in Germany and if they exchanged undercover officers, there must be more undercover officers infiltrated in activist groups here. Now, I know that recently in Hamburg, there was a Maria and Lily who were exposed, similar cases of undercover police officers that infiltrated, I think, the Rote Flora, green groups. There was Stefan Brumma in Heidelberg. So I'm very interested to know more about how these people were exposed, how the research was done. From what I hear, there are similarities in the sense that I think one of the women had pretended to have a job caring for someone, so she was in healthcare. One of the things that we saw is that those undercover officers often have jobs that allow them to go away for weeks at a time. Of course, in fact, they go to their real family, because in the UK they choose undercovers who are married with children, because they hope that will keep them from starting relationships with activist women, which doesn't work. But So they would have jobs that would allow them to go away for a while. I think this Maria had the same thing. Often, undercover officers have more money than the job they have would allow them to have. So that is something that we see every time. Often they have a van, a car, which is very, very handy to transport either equipment or people to activist events. So police would know it in advance. Of course, this list that we now have, it's not, if you have someone you don't trust and you just check all the boxes and you think, yes, we found an infiltrator, but it is something that sort of can help you with recognize patterns. Where am I? Yeah, so questions by the Member of Parliament, both by André Junco, have been very helpful to know, to find out more. There's two things I can talk about. More recent cases of corporate spying. And there's, yeah, I can tell you something about that. What you see in the UK is that most police officers, policemen and women, start at a very early age, 20 to 10, 22, 24 in general, their police career. They have to retire at 30, so then they are still relatively young. They're 50, 54 when they get out. What you often see is they start a second career. We have an example of one of the heads of the animal rights team. He started a company of his own called Global Open, and he sort of specialized in intelligence for companies who are dealing with campaigns of either animal rights activists or other activists. One of his clients was E.ON, a electricity company who has coal power factories in the UK, who are challenged by are the object of campaigns of climate groups. So what we found out is that E.ON has hired Global Open for their security and to develop a strategy how to deal with the activist. But of course, the director of Global Open still has his friends and his contacts within the police and those specific units of the police and all the intelligence they have gathered. There's a similar thing. Scottish Power, which is an energy company as well, has a guy called Gordon Irving, who was the head of special branch, now as the head of security. So that's all very handy. And what we see too is that electricity companies that expect a campaign, they get intelligence not only through their contacts, but also they deal with the Ministry of Energy, and they sort of have the police officer that used to be the head of an intelligence team, now the head of security at an energy company. It's not just a revolving door, but there's the state and the energy company kind of have the same agenda, and that is preventing activism or undermining activism. I could tell a lot more about that, but I'm not going to do it now. One of the things which might be of interest to discuss here is the difference between this kind of intense targeted spying in real life and the online spying or the big data stuff that I think you're dealing here with more than the effects of spying in real life. We could talk a bit about the fact of being targeted by real life spies and being followed around by big data. Or I have, to be honest, no idea how online spying and the data collected by the state online are used or are combined with the intelligence that is won by these infiltrators, how this relate to each other. I've no idea. I think it's it would be interesting to hear from you. Another question would be how hackers could help. What I have learned from the German cases, the exposure of Maria and the other two cases, is I heard, but I don't know, that emails accounts have been hacked, that the data traffic has been analyzed. I don't know anything about it, and it's not something we have done in the UK. On the positive side, there is a very strange development that now the border control is getting more and more strict. And for instance, at a lot of airports, you now have to give your fingerprint if you want to cross the border. This is making it more difficult for undercover officers to cross the border. Officially, of course, they have to make an arrangement between countries. Sometimes they do that, sometimes they don't. But it's, you know, giving someone a good false passport is easier, in fact, than shutting down the entire fingerprint system because one undercover officer might be on that plane. There's another thing. I've told you a bit about how undercover officers try to build a legend, but have a bit of an issue in explaining why they don't see their family, that they can't say much about their former life, about their youth, their school time. Nowadays, everybody's entire life is in social media and on the internet. The Australian government just did a survey among recruits for the police academy, asking how many of them had their life on the internet, and everybody had. So suppose you want to start an undercover operation into a group now, what do you do with the online background of someone? Can you develop an entire social life, a full social life of someone? Can you erase someone's background? So, because like I think with Maria or the other, the Iris, one of the women that was exposed in Hamburg, they knew for sure she was a copper because they found a police magazine with her photograph on it, you know, standing beside a police car. So, you know, that kind of stuff is going to happen more often. Although I think, like, even in real life, there was an example from Spain where people suspected someone of being an officer and they wanted to visit his family. The guy was active in Madrid and he said he was from Barcelona. So he took them to Barcelona. He took them to his mother in a flat where there were photographs of him as a kid. And afterwards, when he was exposed, the activist went back to that flat in Barcelona. It was empty. There was no one there. Neighbors never saw that woman who was supposedly the mother of the. So, you know, they can go a long way in sort of keeping up the legend. But if it's online, it's going to be a whole lot difficult, more difficult. And another positive note to end with is in one of the reports that the internal reviews of the police that we read for fact, we found recruiting numbers of undercover police units. And since this scandal has broke in the UK, recruiting numbers have gone steeply down. So that's an interesting, that's something maybe we won. Although I can't say, of course, that we won't be infiltrated anymore, but it is an interesting number. Okay, I think I'll stop here, or I'll open the floor to questions. There's another microphone here. I know I've been talking about a lot of different issues. I could talk more about one of them. I don't know if there's questions. Is there? If you don't speak in the microphone, this is being streamed. So please, if you have a question, try and use the microphone.
Could you talk a little bit about the commonalities of the background stories? You said some things, but
yeah.
A little bit about the patterns. I'd love to know that.
Yeah, that's okay. What we see is most of the policemen were in there for about 4 years. One of the things that I have discussed is the lack of background or the complicated background, which they both use to explain that nobody could ever see their family, but also as a sort of, well, Kate called it emotional blackmail. They would have very emotional stories about what they had gone through. For instance, Helen's friend, Helen's boyfriend, borrowed money from her to pay for a ticket to go to his mother's funeral, and he wrote her letters and cards about the funeral and how emotional it was. And she later found out that his parents are still alive. So they use the emotional stories to bond with their partners, which is a sort of emotional blackmail or emotional torture, whatever you want to call it. Many of them have skills that come in very handy. I told you about the van. It's very useful in activist circles where people don't have a lot of money. If someone has a van and can drive people around. We know of one who was a locksmith, who changed the locks of many of the houses of activist friends. Very handy in all kind of ways. Mark Kennedy was a climber. So the climate movement, the climate groups there do a lot of, they go to power stations and they climb in the tower, or they sit on the tower for a few days. So it's very handy if you have a climber in a group, because the climb group will often be the group that knows of what the action is going to be about. They will be the first ones. Often they would be more. Yeah. So I think in many activist groups, because there are many students or people go to university or to school. Many of them would pretend to have more of a working class background, which would make them a bit of the odd one out in a group, but accepted nevertheless, because groups want to be open and have to be open. But it is another explanation for maybe being a bit different. And then one of the other similarities is the way they move out, because at a certain point there 4 years is over, and they have to explain why they want to move. And in almost all cases, we see towards the end a mental breakdown or mental problems. Mark Kennedy, for instance, was taken to Scotland for climbing holiday several times because he was so depressed, seemed to be so depressed. You will never know, but in some of the cases, they would not go at once, but they would come back. So maybe a part of the relationship was real, or they had difficulties going back, or it was all part of a bigger plan. We will never know. So to solve their emotional, psychological problems, they would say, I'm going to start a new life in another country. I'm going to Spain, or I'm going to South Africa, or I'm going to Australia. And then a few, of course, this was before the internet time, or most of it, few emails would come, few postcards would come, and then the contact would eventually die down. Like I said, it's very important to not to think if you have someone who ticks all these boxes, you have an undercover officer. But we do see, there was the other thing, there was more money than the job would explain. Good drinkers, most of them were good drinkers, and they were good, like going to the pub, buying everybody, buying friendship, basically. And what you often hear is that an infiltrator, you expect an infiltrator to be the odd one out, or the sort of not wearing the right clothes and being not really into everything. All of the infiltrators exposed in that we know of now were very close to other people, very much in the group. Like the thing I said earlier, that it's good if you suspect someone to form a small group and to act very fast, to do your research, and either confront someone or put an end to it to prevent rumors or to prevent paranoia, kill your group, because that is, you know, one of the ways to ruin a group is to start paranoia and to start rumors. I talked to people in Cardiff where Marco Jacobs was infiltrated, and they said, yes, very good advice, but Marco would have been part of that small group to find out who was the infiltrator, because he was so much in the core of the heart of the group. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks.
Any other questions?
You did. Yeah.
First, so beyond the kind of revolving door between people who work in police and people who do surveillance for corporate entities, have you seen evidence of, or what kind of evidence have you seen of, like, direct cooperation between police and corporate spying? Not just kind of like, oh, you know, I know a friend from my time in the...
Yeah, well, in this London Greenpeace case, there was very close cooperation. We know now from court documents from the McLibel case that the head of security of McDonald's at the time had been a head of special branch, and so whenever there would be a picket in front of a McDonald's shop or McDonald's headquarters, he would invite the animal rights unit back in the days. He would invite them, and they could have a place at the window, and they would share photographs and share their knowledge of names of people involved. So McDonald's always said that they infiltrated London Greenpeace to get to know who was behind that pamphlet that they used for pickets. But they knew from the court case, they knew before they started all this. And even worse, before the corporate spies infiltrated London Greenpeace was also infiltrated by police. By the special demonstration squad. Even worse, one of those undercover agents co-authored the pamphlet that McDonald's later started a court case on. So it's like, I still need to, in my book there is the sort of in-depth case study of London Greenpeace, and with what the corporate spies did and what we knew back then was their involvement with the police. But just before it went to press, Bob Lambert, one of the undercovers, was exposed. So we then knew that he had been in London Greenpeace, and he's the same guy that planted the bomb later on with the other animal rights activist. He fathered a child while he was undercover, and then moved on to be the head of the undercover unit. So it also in the London Greenpeace case, we know that the undercover officers, I get confused myself because it's such a mirror palace. The corporate spies, so the spies hired by McDonald's, went to the police after the Poltex demonstrations, which was big riots in London, and they shared their information with the police. So, it's still a question to me whether McDonald's started this infiltration all by themselves to start a court case, But now that we know that the police was in there before, that the head of the security was an ex-copper, it makes you wonder whether this was it a corporate infiltration at first? Did they use those corporate infiltrators to get the police into the group and then maybe onwards to more radical animal lip people? We don't know. I still have to go. I have to go back and really sit with everything we know new, with the chronology of which spies were in which groups when, and then think about it a bit more. Answer your question.
We have another. Whoops, that's loud. We have another question back here.
One question would be: so you already mentioned that one of the people that you exposed had been treated very confidentially amongst your people, so that it wasn't spread out along amongst the group until it was verified. Now I could imagine that there is a good potential for witch hunting when it comes to that. So. How would you recommend groups to prevent that? How would you recommend to basically be on the watch, but don't become too paranoid, which you also mentioned is an implicit
it's
phenomenon.
Part of my answer,
but
yeah.
I think that's a real danger that you start the witch hunt, basically kills the group, and then it doesn't really matter if they're activists, if there are infiltrators in there or not, because
it will destroy itself. Yeah,
exactly.
We know from books, you know, studies of the FBI, that creating suspicion and creating diversions within groups is one of the reasons to infiltrate, or even not infiltrate. Like you say, rumors can sometimes do the work. Well, I often get this question, of course, and there is no absolute answer, but I do think that groups need to be open. They need to stay open because you want to be open. You want to reach as many people and want to get more people into your group. But at the same time, the work we do and the knowledge we try to disseminate, to spread, is what we want to do is to create at least a bit of awareness that these things can happen. Kate, who I did a talk with yesterday, said, you shouldn't ask me that question, she said, because I was a hardcore anarchist and I thought this would never happen to me. And I had a sexual relationship with one, but I knew five more of the spies and I never thought they would be spies. So creating a bit of awareness, but also be secretive where you need to be secretive and more often. So if you do something like all the things I explained with campaigns and actions against companies, for instance, what you need is a surprise factor. You need the company to be surprised that you're on the doorstep. You need the stuttering company guy who doesn't know what. So if you're gonna do something, maybe the exact goal of your action should be kept secret to the last moment. You invite people to come and you explain it to them what you're going to do on the very last moment. So you make a sort of a risk assessment, to use corporate language. You think about what needs to be secret and what, as much as possible, what can be open. Whisper campaigns and rumors are the worst possible thing. So you always have to be very careful that if there are issues around someone, discuss them with a few trusted people, do some research, trying to find out, and then either leave it behind or confront someone and throw him out or whatever, expose him. But be aware about the damage that rumors can do. And of course, I'm afraid there is no way to prevent yourself from being infiltrated. But I do think that this scandal and the way people are now exposed, I hope it may make things a bit more difficult to for the police to infiltrate groups. Sorry.
You had a relationship to a spy?
Not me, but many of the women that
and
I'm talking
maybe
about.
Maybe it's possible that these women create a video and show it in YouTube, that they connect themselves with speaking about structures and things like that.
Exposing their sexual relationship on YouTube? I don't really understand what you... Are you... You mean exposed the person they have?
Or a woman would have a relationship to a spy is hurt. Yeah?
Yeah,
she's very hurt. And so maybe it is helpful when she contact to another woman, she had the same story.
Well, that actually already happened. And 8 of these women are now in a court case against the police, and they really helped each other. It helped them a lot to find out that they were not the only one, because suppose you're the love, you know, these relationships these women have are very intense, because what happens is that these police officers are trained to be the ideal partner. They mirror you. They know what music style you like, what food you like, which country you like to go on holiday to, and they seem the ideal partner. So when that partner disappears, you're more than hurt, and you want to find out where he went. And at a certain point, you think maybe it was an undercover officer, and all your friends go like, "Oh, come on, you know, get real. Don't start." You know, you have problems, you have to overcome your boyfriend, and you have to forget about it. So the moment these women met each other and, you know, exchanged experience and discovered all the similarities, that was very important. But also, like I explained before, they don't want that personal bit to be the story. The fact is that these relationships were used by the police to get into this group. So they want to expose that fact rather than the more maybe sensational story of, you know, like there's often a sort of James Bond, like spies have women and they have needs, and it's very much, no, it's always about spies being men, partners being women. But you have to remember that these women were used by instruments of the state, and that it is not as much the emotional aspect is important, but they want to talk about how they were used by the state. Any other questions?
So another one.
Hi.
Hey, Anna.
I'm wondering, you said once that when the spies are picked by the police to be spies, they try to choose guys who already have a family to avoid them having relationships. On the other hand, it sounds like the relationships were quite intentional or controlled in an intentional way. That's something I didn't quite understand. Do you think it's actually part of the strategy to have them have relationships, or rather not?
Very good question. Yes, we do know that most of them were married, and we do know that, for instance, there was one of them who was at a certain point in therapy with his real wife, because he was never there, and they had problems, and there were issues in their relationship. And with his activist girlfriend, he was in therapy because he wasn't ready to have children. The handlers must have known. So what I can say is that the fact that they choose married undercovers is something that we got from the internal review. So that is a sort of kind of part of the defense of the police saying we don't want this to happen. The other story that I told, which I totally agree, is totally the opposite. is the analysis of the women in question who try to not talk about their personal relationship, but try to understand it as something that was done by the state. So indeed, it's two conflicting stories, but they're, in a sense, they're both, it's the police story and the women's story. Does that answer your question? Yeah, well, yeah, but you're right, there's an issue there.
There was another question around here.
You gave various examples of groups that were infiltrated, and I can't really figure out for some of them why they got interesting for the police. So my question would be, have you found any kind of pattern of what groups are targeted and, or more general, what the police is hoping to find?
Yeah, very good question. The first unit, the SDS, the Special Demonstration Squad, that existed from 1968 to 2006, had very little rules and very little sort of a context in which they worked. The units that were founded after that, they had a bit more written on paper what they were supposed to do, but the most important unit after that, which has a very long name, is the NPIOU, I think, if I have the alphabet, so the National Police, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't really matter. But their remit was to go after crime that was either crime or public order issues that as a result of domestic are involved with domestic extremism. So normally what you have here in Germany and what you have in other countries as well, the public order remit, the crime remit is the police, because they have to, you know, they have to find criminality, and that goes to court, and then the undercover would have to come to court and would have to testify about what he saw. The public order thing is more intelligence based, and it is it's just information for the police to see, you know, whether they need to go with the right gear or whether they need to interfere or whether they need to do, they don't need to do anything. So one of the reviews that into this specific unit says very specifically the fact that these two tasks were given to the same unit makes it impossible, because if you can't find crime, you just stay in that same group, because it's always interesting to find some intelligence about what they are going to do. So they're in the sort of the few things that were written down, because domestic extremism is not defined anywhere either. It could be anything. If animal liberation, radical activism was included at a certain point because the companies they attacked were part of sort of the economical, corporations very important for the economical state of the country. Those definitions can be, you know, they are flexible, they can go everywhere. So one of the things they say, of course, is that they go into sort of non-radical groups and see who might be willing to go take a step further, to be more radical, to use violence. They might start in a group to get access to a more radical group. They have this stepping stone theory that you have the very fluffy groups, then you have the more serious, then you have the very radical, then you have the people who might want to use violence. So they start at the lower end of the stairs and then they go up. Well, in reality, there is people are all kind of things. They can be very fluffy and maybe they do something else. They start from models that don't make sense to start with at all. And then there is the issue of that there's several stories where undercover officers would suggest to do things that people would not have done otherwise. They would suggest, you know, Mark Kennedy here in Berlin, you know, he was more a black bloc kind of person than he was back in the UK. So he would suggest, we're going to break the lines of the police, or he set fire to something. He did some criminal things here that he wouldn't have done in the UK. Yep. Other questions? What?
I think that was a good question, or is somebody just a little shy? Okay, perhaps you
but
will you.
There was a hand there. There was a hand there. That's your hand.
Come on.
Actually, it's less a question than a kind of, yeah, maybe let's start with a short question. Do you know the reader Schöner Leben ohne Spitze? It's a German Berlin reader of an anti-fascist group.
When was it written?
I think 2 or 3 years ago.
No, I'm not so sure. It. No,
because there was a kind of a spy hunt here as well in one of these groups, and it turned out that there was no spy, and it stressed the group a lot.
Of course, yeah.
To have
yeah.
the spy hunt, and they produced a reader afterwards called Schöner Leben ohne Spitze.
Okay.
And it's all like the same thing.
Yeah, it would be very good to read. I'll
and
look for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, definitely is nice to read. And you can get, I think you also can get some of the questions asked here afterwards, answers for that.
Okay.
In there. And kind of matches quite what you told us here. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's more like an addition or so.
Yeah.
I know somebody else got brave.
Hello. I assume you talked about countermeasures in your groups. What do you think about like very open mutual background checks in such core groups that are forming? Like that you very openly and very kindly like with some beers you just give information that might prove that you are really the person you are pretending to be.
It could be a good idea, but I must also say that the undercover officers make a lot of effort to pass those tests. So the question is whether that will solve your issue. I don't know, some people have reasons why they are running away from a former life, and they have they want to start a new part of their life, and they become more interested in activism, so they don't have a background like having been active for years and years. So would that, I'm just thinking aloud, would a very open background check solve that? I don't know. But it is a thing to think about, it's good. The microphone there, Lars.
I think it would solve at least the aspect of what you told and what many stories have in common, that there was no family, no friends, no social life. And if the groups are more open there, that would help, I think. And that's what I experienced, for example, at the CCC, that you have a more open with each other than I experienced in left-wing groups where it's kind of normal not to expose what you did before and you rather don't ask. Also, it would make sense to ask. I mean, you needn't ask, did you do anything criminal? But to get to know each other, to check if there's a social life of the person before.
Yeah, yeah. We discussed it yesterday because Kate addressed the sort of people having secrets in social movements is making them a bit more cool or more in. Sometimes they try to be more interesting. But Mark Kennedy, by asking her to hide his drug trade past, was playing with that sort of, you know, like by making her a part of that secret, he played with that secrecy, and he also used her to be a bit secretive within the rest of the movement, because she would sort of defend the fact that there was a reason for him not to talk about his past. So what I'm trying to say is that they have ways, they already have ways to play with that, but it is a very good, it is a very good suggestion to think about how can you use very open methods because you don't want to have a sort of secret service of your own who's going to check backgrounds of people you don't trust, of course, because then you become as weird as they are.
Any more questions? Okay, last second.
Please get triggered by the previous question.
Yeah, go
it's
ahead.
It's just that, like, one of the things in some other area is that most alarms are false. And here you have a thing where, like, we are a group, like 10 people, and we all have some degree of suspicion of the other 9.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take, like, you know, there's a false alarm, and you need to react. You know, somebody comes and he's just a Jehovah Witness. Maybe he's scouting the area and he wants to break in. So you shouldn't suspect every Jehovah Witness, but if you react fast and you stay calm because you know that most alarms are false,
mm-hmm.
then the scout knows I'm not going to this neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So the same thing you could do, if we agree that all 10 people, it's okay for them to have some degree of suspicion of the other, and let's talk about it in the open, but let's not jump to conclusion. Most of us are not undercover.
Mm.
I think it's a good state of mind mm-hmm. to develop mm-hmm. strategies.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Good remark.
I think we are now moving into more like a discussion kind, and so perhaps if you stay around a bit, we can do this like on the bar and make like an open discussion with everybody who's still who's interested and want to talk to you, perhaps also is not having to talk to the mic. So I want to thank you for your really nice talk and ask for a big round of applause. So for everybody who's still interested to learn more or perhaps read the books you mentioned, I think you told me you brought some exemplars to whoever is interested to buy one, he can grab one. And of course, you stay here for a little bit of discussion, perhaps can meet at the bar, whoever is interested, just chat you up. And I want to give a big thank you to Seabase for hosting Datengarten today here. As everybody can see, it got really full, so we are really happy to have the space tonight. And so have a great night, everybody.